Senator Doc Setter.
Here.
Senator Hastert.
Here.
Senator Meyer. Senator Perkins.
Here.
Representative Burkhart.
Here.
Representative Esquivel.
Here.
Representative Moniz.
Here.
Representative Nicholas.
Here.
Representative Stubson.
Here.
Representative Wallace.
Here.
Co-Chairman Bebout.
Here.
And Co-Chairman Harshman.
Here.
You have a quorum.
Remind everybody to use their mic. And so I think we're good. Okay, so welcome, Director. Go ahead and get started.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob Budd, Executive Director of the Wildlife Natural Resource Trust. With me is Kim Floyd, who is the Vice Chairman of the Board, and Christine Adams, who is our Grants Manager for the program. I assume, and I'll be very brief, that you want to go through the budget, the exceptions that are in the supplemental, which are, in our case, are reductions. Those were the 8% that the governor asked for. As we analyzed that, I think I gave you a memo that goes through the logic that we used. You should all have that both electronically and a hard copy. And I'm happy to go through those individually if you'd like, or however you'd like to do it, Mr. Chairman.
Director, I think just take us right through it. Yeah, start.
As we looked at the 8%, the areas that we looked at cutting, particularly after having a meeting with Chief of Staff Gray and Mr. Jones, we looked at areas that we could cut that we would not come back in a subsequent period and ask for, really looking for true reductions. We had paid when we had office space rental, we had paid that. That came out completely. That's not something that we would ask for again because we've moved into state space. We were able to reduce out-of-state travel significantly. That was fairly large based on the fact that I was working in several other states on the sage-grouse issue. We helped develop the plan for Nevada, the plan for Utah, started out the process in Idaho, and those are completed. So I think we can reduce the out-of-state travel rather significantly. The others were things we believed we could bring in-house, so to speak, which were printing, some of the things that we can do without going out to a commercial operation, and then the remainder of the reductions came in the 900 series, and that's the reductions that we took. As I said, I do not anticipate seeing us come back in a subsequent budget and try to ask for that again. I think that we would be zero-based as we look at the next biennium. We actually anticipate the potential we may have to make other reductions in that period as well. The other item in the budget, and I think, again, in the memo, it's fairly clear. We understand that we're a discretionary expenditure. We've understood that from day one. So we don't come in and ask for allocations to the corpus of the trust, as an example. The governor asked for $5 million to be put into the corpus to continue to build that source of funding. That originally in the legislation, as you know, asked for a minimum of a $200 million fund, the notion being that when it got to that, then we would come out of the general fund for our operational expenditures. We're about halfway there. So we certainly support the governor's recommendation on the $5 million, again, with the full understanding that that's a discretionary item.
Questions? Senator Dockstader.
Mr. Chairman, are you ready for kind of a series of questions, or is there more
presentation? I think we're ready. Go ahead. If you have questions, go ahead.
All right. Mr. Budd, as I recall, when we started the trust, didn't we start with just one employee? We have two now?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. We originally started, the authorization was two employees. Until we kind of got all of us together on the same page philosophically and the program started running, we did not hire an employee. We did hire an employee in late 2006 or early 2007. That employee left. I replaced that with a part-time employee who was there for 2 years. When that contract finally expired, we advertised the job, which then we lost in the 10% reductions when Governor Friedenthal asked for reductions. They swept that position back because we had not filled it, and then we got this position that Christine has a little over a year ago. As the volume of work has increased almost exponentially, we needed to have an additional person to handle, particularly the grant side.
Well, continue to follow up, Mr. Chairman. You've kind of answered that, but if push came to shove and we're trying to meet this budget, could you operate the trust on one employee without diminishing any of the work of the other, the extra employee you have now?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe we could. We're managing over 400 grants right now. Some of those are payments that we make almost on a bi-monthly basis. We've got everything we do is contractually bound through the Attorney General. For both of us, as we work through that period every 6 months doing grants, it's a pretty steady, nonstop progression of actions that have to take place. I'm not going to tell you it would be impossible to operate it. It would be very, very difficult.
All right. Mr. Chairman, if I could, two more. And you've done great work out there. I've toured your projects. Is it possible to run the board with a smaller number, and would that really save you that much? Say you went nine to five board members rather than nine, travel expenses and so forth. Any cost savings there, and could you actually do the same job you're doing now?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dockstader, is it possible? Yes. I think that it would be, I don't believe there would be any cost savings at all. We would still have the same number of site visits that someone would have to go to. So it probably would mean that instead of paying one board member mileage to go, we'd pay another one mileage to go to it anyway. I think the workload, and certainly Vice Chairman Floyd can answer to this from a volunteer point of view, the workload would be rather extraordinary. We look at about 80 to 100 projects a year with those nine people. Now, the staff obviously picks up a fairly large percentage of those, but we try to have two people on every site visit, so that's, you know, one person, and as you know, you've been on site visits, how we do that. I don't think the savings would be significant. We would save travel for however many volunteers to about 4 to 5 meetings a year is what we would probably end up saving.
All right. One final question, Mr. Chairman, if I could. Yes, I have seen your projects. You've done a lot with, not a lot of money to work with, but based on what you've done with $100 million, could you continue to do that much without reaching the $200 million mark?
Mr. Chairman, the reason we've been able to do as much as we have is because we have a blended source of funding, which started back when the program began, when Chairman Philp was designed that, actually, from the House side. And that is that we have general fund money that's used for projects, we have interest from the trust that's used for project, and we have private funds that come in. They're not a huge significant portion. We've had about $2.7 million in private funds over the last 6 years. If we went to the $200 million, then the question becomes, and frankly I think the model is designed such, that we would not come and ask for general fund appropriations because the interest on the corpus of the trust would generate an equivalency. And that's all we've ever asked for from the general fund, is an equivalency with what the $200 million would generate to do projects. So I think we would be at the same place if we had the $200 million as far as workload as where we are today, absent the fact that we wouldn't be asking for general fund appropriations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Bob.
Other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Come to my, we've been reading the media. There's a lot going on with conservation easements in the state right now. Can you kind of go through a little bit of how that's proceeding and understand there's a land trust that's closing down? We're contemplating transferring those to other things. And I think you know my concerns from our conversations in the past about what we're doing to our future generations by tying up our resources in these things. And just kind of go over that for me, if you would.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wallace, that's a huge open-ended question, and I'll try to. Let me answer it in two parts. The first is your first question, which is what is going on with conservation easements. We are doing more than we normally would do right now in direct response to the attempt to not have a listing of the sage grouse. The vast majority of easements being done are directly related to sage grouse habitat. The Fish and Wildlife Service has said, and we have it in writing, that is a credible regulatory mechanism to preclude a listing of that species. We had a significant infusion of federal money that came in to help kickstart that program through the Farm and Ranch Protection Program in the NRCS. And so the board has taken a pretty serious approach to try and reduce the threats, which is how the listing decision will be based on whether or not you've abated the threats to the species. And this is one way to do that. So that's why we have more activity now than we are going to have in the future, and more than we've had in the past. We are in a bubble of about probably 3 to 4 years where we're going to see a lot of easements. And I think certainly Senator Bebout can relate this to you as well. I showed a graphic at the Select Committee that shows how this happens over time. If you go back and look in 2007, all we did were wetlands. When you look at 2009, the bulk of what we were doing were aspen enhancements. Right now, that peak is in easements. So to your second question relative to the Wyoming Land Trust and their status, I'm not on the board. I have talked to them. Obviously, they're having some serious difficulties. As you know, it's tough for NGOs now. Just got an email yesterday, a very troubling email from the wool growers, the same kind of thing. They had a model, an economic model, that assumed that they would have a higher level of philanthropic support than what they got. What they, I think, will tell you is that their revenues reduced, and they had to analyze what they're going to do. Now, I don't think that, and this has been my counsel to them, I don't believe that they should close up shop until they have their obligations that they have to the landowners and others met. What that means is that in every easement, and Senator Perkins has worked on these, I think can relate to this, every easement has a provision in it as to what happens if the landowner wishes to transfer that easement to someone else, and that happens, not often, but it does. There's also one if the holding entity goes defunct that says that they have the responsibility to work with the landowner to transfer it to a qualified holder of the easement. That process started a week ago, and I just was out this week with a landowner and a land trust that will probably assume their project. I think that I've talked to all of the other land trusts in the state. The bulk of the people who are in the position of having a transfer want them to stay in a state entity, and I think that's what they're trying to accomplish as well. That process won't happen overnight. That's going to take time, and so that's why I think that the Wyoming Land Trust, in whatever form, needs to continue to be an entity and move forward. I hope that answers your question, Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It does, and thank you. But I think it alarms me more than I was before, and I was pretty alarmed before. So now we have a situation where we have these vast land areas with all of their resources balled up in a situation where those assets to the state, to the people, to the families, are now subject to a completely different group, some of whom may be virulently opposed to the things that have sustained our state for ever, and we're losing more and more control over our own destinies. Convince me I'm wrong.
Mr. Chairman, I think that is a harsh view of perhaps what could happen. The reality is that the landowners who have the easements are intact. Okay, this doesn't change the fact that the easements do what they do. And what they do is they keep the land in agriculture. They maintain the open spaces. They allow for mineral production. They basically say you can't build houses on this property. Now, to that end, the landowner has a considerable, if not the absolute, ability to determine where they're going to go. I had a conversation last night with someone on the board of the Wyoming Land Trust who said, do you think we have the right to just assign the easement? And my answer was absolutely not. And if need be, I think that the state and this agency will be in a position to step in and say, that's not how we're going to do it. I think it's our job to protect the resources of the state, including the human resources. So I think what you'll see happen is they will look at entities that best suit them. For example, in your part of the state, it may be the Sheridan Community Land Trust. It may be the Stock Growers Land Trust if it's an agricultural operation. They'll have the ability and opportunity to make that kind of a choice, as opposed to just assigning it out of the, you know, out of the blue to someone. I will assure you that my board and myself are not going to stand by and allow that to happen.
Representative Esquil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Budd, going back to the grants, are some of those grants reoccurring that the same project gets a grant every year, or do you just look at them individually? And as when the fund is fully operational, what do you anticipate that you'll be managing, how many grants per year by then?
Mr. Chairman, the first question, we have the way that the projects come in, they're everyone is unique. And we'll have a project that comes in that's a $25,000 project to reconstruct a head gate to allow fish passage and improve irrigation efficiency. They build the project, it's done, we're billed, we're out, it's over. There are others that come in that, when we do the site visit, we ask, how long is this going to take, what is it going to cost in total, and what are you looking at as far as an implementation plan? So if you look at Bates Creek out of Casper, that was looked at as probably a 15-year completion. It will cover everything from the west end of Casper Mountain clear down to Wheatland on the Laramie Range. It will include hundreds of landowners and probably cost on our side, which is going to be about a quarter of that in the end, it'll probably cost somewhere in the vicinity of $4 to $5 million over that 15 years. Well, the board's not going to allocate $5 million and then try and bind up future boards to allocate that over 15 years. So what we say is, no guarantees you're going to be funded at every step, but tell us what you can do in 2 years or three, which is our contract period, and that's what we'll fund, then we'll evaluate. Let's say that the treatment isn't working, and we ran into that in one case with a Russian olive and salt cedar removal. The technology wasn't right. The board curtailed the funding, said get the technology right, show us it'll work. They came back, did it, then the board moved ahead with the funding. But the ones that tend to be longer term are cut into discrete pieces, discrete landscapes, and then they can extend as they move out.
And Mr. Chairman, I guess with all that said, it surprises me they're able to do all that with just two employees. Thank you.
Ms. Kocher.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I know Sue asked this question, but I want to talk a little bit more about the Wyoming Land Trust itself and the bankruptcy. I heard they went bankrupt. I don't know. Maybe it's imminent. And the transition. And we have contracts with them, and I don't know how much we've done with them. I guess my first question is, how much have we done with them? The second question is, what's the status in terms of our agreement? And I'm sure you've covered this, Bob, because I know you pretty well, and there's ways you've got to transition for this happening. So could you just, and the amount of money involved, could you bring me up to date on that, please?
Mr. Chairman, Chairman Bebout, I did a calculation the other day just to see kind of what we had outstanding with the Wyoming Land Trust in terms of contracts. It's about $2.6 million. There are, I believe, 11 projects that are not completed that we have funding in, or maybe 14. I can get that for you, but it's in that does an area. None of those, the thing that's really important to understand is that we don't pay for anything up front. They have to be completed. So there's no money in their account that belongs to the state. In other words, they're not sitting on money waiting to spend it on a project. They get it when the project's complete. And that's the protection we have for the people of the state, that somebody doesn't take money, go bankrupt, and we're out. So that's not a risk. The management of those grants that we have right now, again, we have talked to all the other land trusts, the only other entity that in Wyoming that perhaps would hold an easement would be Game and Fish, and they're included in that conversation if a landowner wanted them to do it, and said, which of these are you willing to pick up, or which of these do you believe we need to do? Clearly, the sage-grouse projects are at the top of that list, and they're scrambling to get those done. The ones that either look like they don't have a home to go to that are pending, we will simply let that contract expire, and there will be no money spent, and the project won't happen. I would anticipate that some of those that are in the queue will go away of the landowner's accord. They'll just say, the uncertainty is a little bit much for us now, and we just as soon wait, maybe reapply. That's certainly fine as well. The one in the large project bill, I anticipate, will be transferred to another entity. They've already had that meeting with the landowner. But those are probably the three things that will happen. The ones that we have contributed to in the past, that obviously we have an interest in as the state, as I said to Representative Wallace, we are going to be involved in the process of transferring those to make sure that the state's investment is protected.
Mr. Chairman, the thing, too, is, and I've been on the wrong side of too many bankruptcies, and what I worry about, of course, is the way we set this all up was the state couldn't own the easements. I mean, we can't own them, and by, constitutional provision, and we all know all about that. And so you have to have, once it's completed, it has to transfer to that trust, and so that is an asset. That has some value. And if you actually go into a bankruptcy or liquidation, then everybody's going to come after that. And if they do complete it, and we've got our money in it, and we've done that, then that has value. And so then it could be in a bankruptcy court that could be attached, or the unsecured creditors could go after that. I don't want to get into bankruptcy law with you, Bob, but have you asked AG or someone? I know you have a staff attorney. Have they looked at that to just be sure the state and your outfit's protected?
Mr. Chairman, we have not, because, as you're well aware, the announcement of this came out this week. The other part is there's not been a bankruptcy declared. What has happened, to my understanding, and I probably need to ask them these questions, my understanding in talking to them, what has happened is their cash flow will not sustain the people that they had on staff. So they've laid off three of their staff. They've retained one on a part-time basis, and they are analyzing what their options are. In talking with their board, there are numerous options. One is to retool and go back out and try and fundraise. Another is to go to a more volunteer-driven entity. Another is to go back to a localized Green River Valley Land Trust. I think they're in the process right now of simply exploring what those options are. So there's not an immediate bankruptcy. That's why I think it's important that in the provision of our contract and in those easements themselves, that transfer provision would happen before any bankruptcy would be declared and before they would close up their shop. That's what we have requested.
Well, and what you don't know, Mr. Chairman, and you'll only find out after the fact, and there's nothing you can do, is what, in fact, that group may or may not have done relative to security. And, when things get tough financially, a lot of things happen. But you're on top of it, and I've got confidence in that. Tell me about how many easements we have with the conservation fund.
I can look that up. While I'm doing that,
just get it back to us.
Oh, okay.
There's some concern has been raised to me and other members of this committee, and what you do from your perspective is you don't look at necessarily what the fund is all about and what they do, what they believe in or don't believe in. You look at somebody that can do what you're trying to do with your mission. I understand that. but there's some concerns about that particular one, and so I'd just like to see what you have on it and some information. And do you do a background check? I mean, I know you do financially and all that, but do you do anything more? You know, could I put a trust together and call it whatever and come to you and say I'm going to do all this? Do you do some kind of background into me personally and those kind of things to see what I'm all about before you move forward and see where I may be going with all of that in terms of trying to secure some of these funds?
Mr. Chairman, there's about 3 points there, and I will get that to you. The quick answer is I don't know if the Conservation Fund holds any easements at all. They may hold one in the state, maybe two, and I'll get the exact number to you. They raise money, and that money is to do easements. Most of the easements that they have worked on in the state are actually held by the Stock Growers Land Trust, so they do them in partnership. If you look at the Summers Grindstone Project, almost every entity in the state was involved in that one way or another. The project sponsor was the Game and Fish Commission. The easements are ultimately held by the Stock Growers Land Trust. So they work together. It's actually a very elegant little dance at times and quite interesting to watch. But I will find out for you. As far as the background check, I've never worked with a more diligent board. And they, I mean, having a board appointed by judicial districts gives you some assurance that people know what's going on in those backyards. So if somebody came in and formed a land trust and said, this is the Wallace Esquibel Land Trust, and here we are.
I like the sound of that.
Yeah, and came in and applied for money, absolutely we're going to look at what their resources are, what kind of backing they have, who's on their board, whether or not they're a legally formed company in Wyoming. That's part of our contractual obligation. But as far as I'm certainly not, I have no capacity to go do background checks or anything like that, and it isn't a formalized thing that we've ever done, but I feel very comfortable that we know what they're doing and that the board really takes a close look at how well they're capitalized and that sort of thing.
And Mr. Chairman, I thought that you had done that, and it's always after the fact. You know, that's where you find out about it.
Oh,
and that's where then you're criticized, and you know all of that happens. So, and then the quick question about biennialized, we're in good shape there on this one, right, Don?
Mr. Chairman, you're correct. There's no math issues there. They may have some difficulty because they've chosen to reduce like utilities, and they probably will not be able to reduce that to zero. But they don't have any math.
I don't know. In Fremont County, you know, we do a lot of things differently up there.
That's right.
Any other questions? So I think, Senator Myers.
A couple of things, Bob. Just one comment. As a chairman, I've been on the wrong side of bankruptcies before. One thing I do know about bankruptcy court, that if there's a deal made in light of a pending bankruptcy, the bankruptcy judge will sweep that back in because they don't have any brother-in-law deals. So wherever you're at, I don't think you can deal your way out of it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, I think that's right, if there were a bankruptcy, but there is not. The other point that I think it's important to make is, while some people would view a conservation easement, and the word is used as an asset, it is actually a liability.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're not going to come in and have somebody want to sweep up your liabilities in a bankruptcy. And so you're transferring a liability, which someone else then, as a trustee, is holding. And that's how an easement works. So it's not a cash asset somebody can trade on the open market.
Okay. The other thing, Bob, and I apologize because I stepped out for a moment whether this question has been answered or asked and answered, is that what's the appetite with your partners now for conservation easements? You know, the economy's kind of flatlined, and I'm just wondering or not whether you have the same resources or whether they've been diminished, and if so, how much?
Mr. Chairman, I think I could categorize the attitude, and some of them are here, you could ask them, as cautious, very, very cautious. Many of them are 501s. They're a charitable contribution type organizations. They are looking, the ones that I've talked to are very, very careful about what their assets are, how many operating, they're doing what you do here, frankly. Mm-hmm. They're looking at how long into the future, what happens if they have a 25% decrease in their contributions or their assets. The interesting thing is that many of them are doing quite well in light of a reduced philanthropic flow of money. The other thing that I think you're seeing, the focus is very strong, again, on the sage-grouse thing where you have external funds that are coming in to serve that purpose. So, but I would characterize it as extremely cautious right now.
Okay, I think we're about ready to wrap up. Does anybody else have any? Appreciate your good work. Keep up the good work, and I'm sure we'll have more debates as we mark up and look at those dollars. So appreciate your good work. Anyone else? Okay, thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Next up is environmental quality. Director Ruby, if you want to introduce folks or...
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jim Ruby. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Environmental Quality Council. With me today is our Vice Chair, I think most of you know him, Mr. David Searle. He's here to kind of guard my back, I think. We have no supplemental budget request. We're here simply to answer any questions you may have. We are probably one of the few agencies in the state right at the moment who because of a lack of litigation, this budget cut won't have any impact on us at this stage unless something drastically changes in the next 12 months. So the 8% cut will, we're glad to work it out, and it won't have any negative impacts on our abilities to do work at this stage of the game. If you have any questions for us, I'd be happy to answer them.
Representative Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Ruby, looking at those budget cuts, the impression I get is it's sort of a function of the ebb and flow of the amount of your work. And my question is, going forward, as we look forward especially to the next biennium, the impression I get is that if you see some additional hearings, these cuts could go away fairly quickly and you could be in asking for additional money, depending upon the number of hearings you have. And is that an accurate interpretation of these numbers? And do you have any thoughts about going forward how we could plan for some sort of sustainable budget cuts in the long term?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, that's a great question because you're absolutely right. Everything that we do is driven by other people. It's driven by how the Department of Environmental Quality handles its permitting and rulemakings. It's dependent upon how the public views what the department has done. It depends upon the economy itself as to whether or not we have an increase in the number of permits, applications, and whether those are in locations that people object to. All driven by people outside of all of our control. I can tell you that I came here in 2008, and at that point in time, we were really busy. And we, in fact, did come to the governor and to the legislature and ask for an additional appropriation in our second year of that biennium because we were just swamped. And we had not been appropriated a sufficient amount of monies to kind of deal with that kind of influx of cases. And that had been an ongoing scenario for a while before I got here. When I got here, the council decided that we would basically try and do our budget on a three-year rolling average. So we would look at the past 3 years of cases and stuff and try and get to see if there was some kind of trend that was developing that we could at least try and do a decent job of identifying what might be coming down the road for us. And so... And we've also have engaged in long conversations with the department with regards to what kind of rulemakings they may have coming down that will impact our work. And what we're seeing right now is a trend, and mostly the trend is in the Northeast, where the coal bed methane was a large controversial subject for a very long time. That has certainly calmed down considerably. And at least in the short term, and when I say short term, I say the next 18 months or so, I don't think we're going to see a large increase in our caseload. What has been surprising is we haven't seen an increase in the cases in the solid waste division, where, as legislators, you know, you've been dealing with some very controversial issues with regards to landfills and how to deal with those over the long term. But we haven't seen a large increase in the number of cases coming out of that issue, which is surprising. As you know, there was the increase. You know, there was a lot of talk about increases in uranium mining. Now, we've had several permits go through, but we've only had one that actually ended up being a contested case before the council, and that case really had everything to do with sage grouse and very little to do with the actual mining of uranium. And so, for whatever reason, I think mostly, though, it's the economy, we have seen a significant decrease in the amount of litigation and the contentiousness surrounding some of the what some people view as kind of contentious, you know, practices within natural resources development.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned in your budget, the location of your hearings and that there's some budgetary impact on the location of your hearings. And I wasn't sure. I would assume most of them are here in Cheyenne, but are there statutory requirements on where your hearings have to be held?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, there are in certain cases. Most of the cases we have, there is not. But what we try to do and what the council's tries to do is to hold the hearings as close as possible to the location of the permit application where the mine or the process or the water discharge or whatever, air quality discharge, whatever, may be occurring to minimize the impact to the degree possible on the parties with having to travel and bring witnesses a long distance. We are required by law to hold 4 meetings a year, whether we have anything to do or not. The statute says we shall have 4 meetings a year. We have not had a problem with having something to do. Don't get me wrong on that point. But it is clear that in several instances we are required to go to the county in which the permit, the mine, or the subject of the permit is located. But the council does try diligently. We have, since 2008, we have organize ourselves so that we have a meeting every other month, and as long as there's something to do. We have canceled meetings, but we do that in order to give the public and the department an idea of if they bring a case, when will they be looking at seeing it on the actual hearing, and it gives them an ability to make a plan with regards to knowing when they might actually have a rulemaking hearing or when they might have the contested case hearing. By doing that, we've given some certainty to parties. And it has really helped the council kind of then spread their work across the state and kind of make sure that they're available to the parties where they can be.
Any other questions? Senator Meyer?
A couple things. Could you kind of give us in a percent or by number or both, if you know, the high level of activity over the course of the last 10 years and the low level of activity as far as cases or workload or however you'd like to describe it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, I can't give you the exact numbers. I can get to you, though, that information from our annual reports. I can tell you that we are at the low. We really are. We have one active rulemaking case right now, and we have one active contested case right now. We have several contested cases that are on our docket. The parties have asked for it for them to they believe they've reached settlement, but there are sometimes external issues like with EPA or the feds that we can't control that they've got to deal with before they can actually finalize their agreement. And so we have several of those sitting on our docket, but are anticipated to go away once they've reached the final settlement with the EPA on their some of those side issues. Our high was definitely probably the period between 2002 to 2008, and that was really the heated battles over the coal bed methane and the water discharges in the Powder River Basin area. Those have certainly calmed completely down. We haven't seen one of those in almost 18 months. And so, and I can tell you that at one point, I can't give you the near year, but there was a caseload of at least 20 cases pending on the docket in various stages, not just all at once, you know, but at various stages. And that was over like a one-year period that those came in and had to be dealt with. And there was a period that the docket for the council was taking upwards of 18 months to get a case processed. We have not had a case run 18 months since 2008.
Okay. Follow-up is, what kind of workload increase would you expect if we had primacy over greenhouse gas emission, or would it change at all, or what's your slant on that going forward?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, you know, whatever the air quality standards may be, whether we have primacy or not, I don't know that it will impact us considerably. Over the past couple of years, there has been a process going through with SO2 and several of the other emissions where they've tightened the restrictions down, and they've been required to do what is called best available retrofit technology. We had two cases come before us. One was Basin Electric and one was Pacific Corp, in which people contested whether or not they were using the best available retrofit technology. That all ties in with what they call the regional haze rules that have to be developed. Now, I'm going to have to say that if on all of that stuff, you really want to talk with DEQ Air Quality, Steve Dietrich, and Todd Parfit with regards to how all that is going to work out. It is my understanding, though, that the Air Quality Division is busy, but we have not seen any cases come to us at this stage. So I don't think if we take supremacy over greenhouse gases, depending upon what the standards are, depending upon what those standards then might cause within the airshed, we might see a couple more cases, but those will be some years down the road, because I'm assuming, and you know what happens when you do that, that there will be at least a few years period of time where the science has to figure out what is the numbers, what are the standards going to be, and then all the testing that will have to be done to figure out what any given source is putting out and how best, what is the technology to reduce that. And so I would not see us having one in our cases within this biennium on greenhouse gases unless something drastically changes with regards to how fast those standards are developed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
About ready to wrap up. There'll be some biennialization issues. I mean, they're not in this cut, but moving forward, the targets might get a little steeper as we look at proposed 8% cuts in the next biennial budget. But appreciate your good work and appreciate your time here.
Yes. Real quick, like Mr. Chairman, you might consider, too, I know you've got, three people that on staff, and you're at $625,000 for your biennial budget for your section, your 100 series, and you know, things slow down, and Dave, you know, for being on the board, you might consider, I think they're all at will, right? You're the only one that's at will.
Just me.
You might just look at some ways to, you know, as we move forward with some cuts and you're doing less, you might look at ways to save some money there, but that's down the road.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bebout, and actually we're working with two staff right now. One of our staff moved on, took another job. Family moved to Denver, and so for the past past 5 months, we have been working with just one. We did advertise, but we have reduced the staffing level from what was a senior support office specialist, which is kind of high in the family chain, down to an office assistant two, which is, even if we do fill it, and we haven't finalize that determination, we'll still continue to save in just cash alone and just salary alone $1,000 a month. So we are looking at those things. We are also looking at if in fact there are things that our office historically, the DEQ and the EQC have shared staff. In the very beginnings, the DEQ was, and the statute still sits out there, that DEQ shall provide staff, certain levels of staff for the EQC, and they have done that over the time, and they still do that within the accounting division and some of that stuff. We have tried diligently to maintain a separation that allows for people to believe that there isn't any kind of either appearance or actual conflict between the agencies. But I can tell you that we work diligently with DEQ to try and make sure that if there are things that we can do shared, that we do them.
And, well, that's good. You do have one vacant position, then, is what you're saying.
At this point, yes.
Okay, that's it. Thanks.
Very good.
Thanks for coming. Thanks,
okay, Dave. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, next up is Agency 20, DEQ. So, go ahead. I think these guys...
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I believe the fire prevention and electrical safety is up next.
It's not what I got.
Not what I have. If they're not here, right? So we'll.
They're right there.
You're here, I know, but the DEQ. Here's DEQ. I have. Don, I have.
I got DEQ next.
I have DEQ next, but is there some issue we don't know about?
Mr. Chairman, if there is an error, it's my fault. I believe Fire Prevention and Electrical Safety called ahead and said they had a meeting up in Casper, so they asked to be moved in front of DEQ for 45 minutes.
And this is a 15-minute time slot for fire prevention. Okay.
I don't know. Should we do this for Lanny? I don't know. Boy, the points you're adding up. Paybacks are you know what.
Yeah. So we'll hold DEQ off for 15 minutes or less. And I think I remember that now, this conversation. I just don't have it on my schedule. So we'll go ahead with fire prevention for 15 minutes, and then DEQ will have really the last 45 before we finish at 10. Okay, so welcome, Lanny. If you'd have anyone introduce your folks, and go ahead and get started.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I have with me, to my right, our budget manager, Kim Saline, and behind me, I have my chief deputy, fire marshal, Mike Carlson, and to his right, Bruce Trembath, who's our chief electrical inspector. Thank you for hearing us and hearing us early. We're traveling to Riverton today is where we're going, so for meetings. Mr. Chairman, on the budget cuts that were requested of us, the 8%, we knew early on because of the cuts that we'd take a couple years earlier that this was going to affect some personnel. And so going into that, if you recall, there was a time frame where Governor Meade did a cap on the number of personnel within your agencies. And so we lost one position due to the cap. We were proposing to fill that. But we didn't have it filled at that time, and so that was part of it. And then right after that, we had the position in Riverton at the Fire Academy, our Fire Academy coordinator. He left our agency and went to another state agency, and that opened that position. So what we did is, through attrition, if you will, we made our cuts, and we had a training manager in Cheyenne, and we knew that we had to, suck it up like everybody else, and so what we did is we just combined positions. We moved that position from Cheyenne to Riverton, and so the individual in Riverton is doing dual duties, if you will. He's acting as the Fire Academy coordinator plus the training program manager for our training division. And that's worked out for the most part well. The communications is not as fluent as it was when he was in Cheyenne, but so we're making a lot more phone calls than we used to, but it's working, and we believe it's working well. I got a document from him just a couple days ago and asked him to line it out of how that's had an effect on the training division and the academy. And the only thing negative he had to say was the fact that the communication is not as fluent when we run each other in the hallway day to day. But other than that, we're making it work, and it's working well. And we'll do what's necessary.
Yeah, one question,
okay, Mr.
Chairman. Thanks, Lanny. Good to see you here. But in reality, by having someone out in the central part of the state, what you may lose from being down here, you gain, and that's because it's out in the state. Is that why you did it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bebout, that's correct. We looked at a lot of different areas that we could do it without moving that position and just replacing the one that left. And there wasn't another way that was going to work well. We're in the electrical division. We issue over 9,000 electrical licenses through our office, over 2,200 electrical permits. And so the electrical division was out. And of course, although economies dropped back a little bit, our folks out there doing these electrical inspections and the fire inspections, they're still staying busy. Our plan reviewer, we've had some lulls in there. But right now, it's up as what is normal for this time of the year. So we're not, they're still building out there in a lot of places. So that was the best fit, was to mix those two positions. And like I say, it's worked, and it's worked well. And we actually considered that before this happened, years ago. And sometimes things happen for a reason. Well, it did. And it's working. It's working well.
You know, our staff kind of were, as we look at these cuts, we're trying to figure out which ones can be biennial eyes as we move forward in the next budget next year. And it looks like with our data, about half of yours can. And so just kind of as a heads up, I mean, as we move forward into these 8% reductions in the next biennium, kind of this early planning will be crucial. Mm-hmm. On ways to really control expenditures and come up with that next round of cuts. So we appreciate all the good work you're doing. And is there any other questions, Senator Haskell?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since we have just a quick moment here. Now, it's fair to say that your electrical, your part of your task is to prevent electrical fires. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Haskell, well, we do our best to try to prevent them. We certainly inspect the facilities as much as we can. On the average, our inspectors, we're probably, and Bruce could probably give us a better number, but I'm guessing statewide through all of our inspectors, we're probably only still looking at 25-30% of the inspections that are out there. But we're hitting the main ones as much as we can.
And is lightning not electrical? And I was wondering what you're doing to control forest fires.
Well, right now we're doing rather well with forest fires. We actually have a Mr. Chairman, Senator Astor. We have an ongoing joke between us and State Forestry. I always tell them that from about November 1 through March 1st, I'll take care of the wildland fires, and we don't seem to have a big issue. But he has a heck of a problem, so.
Mr. Chairman, I asked for a supplemental on that.
Mr. Chairman, I have one more thing. What time are you going to Riverton?
In about an hour.
Okay.
Or earlier.
Wait for no.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Thanks for coming in. Appreciate your good work.
Thank you.
We'll be in Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman.
Okay. Next up is DEQ. And thank you. He went out to get his bench line up there.
Word professional, professional, word professional.
Actually, we've got two more now. We've got DEQ and insurance this morning. And insurance will be a short. We don't want to get into the Affordable Care Act with that one. That's a different issue for the health department, so. Different issue. I don't think this is the day, this is the group to visit. Well, we don't want to get. Okay, Director, I'm going to introduce your lineup, and we'll go ahead and get started.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. Just for the record, my name is Todd Parfit. I'm the director for the Department of Environmental Quality. And with me today is, to my right, Jim Uzel, the Management Services Administrator. We have Steve Dietrich, the Air Quality Administrator. Carl Anderson, administrator for the Solid and Hazardous Waste Division. Carol Bilbro, who is a manager within Land Quality, and she's here representing Nancy Nutbrock, who is the administrator for land. We have Alan Edwards, administrator for the Abandoned Mine Lands Program, and then John Wagner, the administrator for the Water Quality Division. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to just point out that we did have some handouts. I think there are five PowerPoint slides, so if you would mind referring to that as I go through the supplemental budget. What I'd like to start with is page 2 on the handout, and this is in reference to the information technology reductions. This is separate from the 8% reductions. And the two areas where there were information technology reductions, the first had to do with the FTEs, full-time employees associated with IT within the agency. We had 6 full-time employees and 1 at-will contract employee within the agency when the last biennial budget began. With the creation of the Enterprise Technology Services Agency, we had conversations with the CIO about those positions and where those would be most appropriately located. We mutually agreed that 3 of the FTEs and the at-will contract position were most appropriately located in the ETS agency, and we retained 3 full-time employees. So the 3 FTEs, the at-will contract employee, and the associated funding were moved over to ETS. The second item related to the IT reductions is related to the general funds for IT-related activities within the agencies, and those were also moved over to the Enterprise Technology Services. In addition, any IT-related federal funds were also moved into the indirect cost category for recovery under the statewide cost allocation plan. So I wanted to bring that up first because that applies throughout the budget. You'll see that in column 4 in the summary tables throughout, so I won't touch on that each time. Okay. Now if I could refer you to page 6 of our supplemental budget, and what you see here is a summary of the 8% reductions. The total reductions, $1.4 million. Those are the governor's recommendations, and we support the governor's recommendations on that, on those 8% reductions. One thing I do want to point out is there is a slight discrepancy. If you look at the first column where it says division number, go down to 400 and professional fees, you'll see that the there's a reduction of $200,000. That differs from what is under the Land Quality Division, and I'll get into that and explain that difference when we get there. But I wanted to point that out for you. So now if I can direct your attention to page 3 of the handout. And to page 12 of the supplemental budget. For administration, the reduction under the 8% is $214,000, and that includes reductions for administration, information technology support, and industrial siting. And those reductions are in support services and professional fees, and we support the governor's recommendation there. So if there are no questions related to administration, then I'll move on. So
were any of these reductions things that you contemplated in light of not having a budget cut, things that you may have done just as a matter of course of business because of lack of workload?
Mr. Chairman, these budget cuts were done specifically as part of the 8% reduction. And, for example, we adjusted our replacement schedule for computers in this particular instance from a 4-year cycle to a 5-year cycle. That's something that we hadn't contemplated prior to looking at these 8% reductions.
Okay. Anyone else?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So now I direct your direct your attention to still page 3 of the handout, but moving to page 17 of the budget document. And this is for air quality. And the reduction under air quality is all under professional fees in the amount of $180,000 associated with a reduction in some monitoring equipment for a project that was complete, and so there was no need to maintain that equipment moving forward. We had collected the information that we needed with that particular project.
Mr. Chairman? Yeah, on that particular one, this would be something that would have happened anyway, because you pretty much, as I read it, in fact, what you just said, what you intended to do has been completed, and you would be doing this anyway, so... This might be something that you would not have done. I mean, you would have done even without the 8%. Is that correct?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, in this instance, yeah. This is something that we had a project completed, and going through this process, we identified that as something we didn't need to have going forward.
And Mr. Chairman, in that regard, what did you have, what was the total allocation budget-wise you had for this for the two-year cycle? What did you have budgeted for it, and then how much did you spend? I guess you would just take what you had budgeted minus 180, and that's what you spent. So that's the number I'm looking for.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I might look to Mr. Dietrich. I don't have an answer for that. But
just get back on that one,
okay.
Would you please?
Yeah.
Yeah, what I'm curious, Steve, is just to find out what you budgeted, you completed it, and did you in fact complete it? You know, you don't need any more money, it's done, and this is all that's left, or there's still more in that particular account. Or that project.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Moving on to the Water Quality Division, take you to page 21 of the budget document. And under water quality, the reduction was $557,000, rounding up. And those were reductions in support services and professional fees.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, and Don, anything, you know, these are pretty much all the same about the biannualization issue, but if there's anything that reaches out, please jump in and as we go through them and let us know, would you please?
Go ahead. Don, I think as I look at many of yours are, there's not as many biannualization issues. How many of the ones we've covered so far, what do you see? Are there any?
Mr. Chairman, you have one that on page 22, relative to water quality, you can see that they have taken $94,000 out in out-of-state travel. And if you doubled that, it would be about $188,000. They don't have that much money in that line item, so they're about $50-some thousand short. That's the first item. There are two more later on, one in land quality and one in solid waste that can't be biannualized.
So most of these, and Director, what we're kind of looking at is, and you heard kind of the same speech before, so as we go forward, we're looking at how we're going to find these 8% in the next biennium. And so, and you guys, I mean, a lot of it is can be biennialized as we move forward, and you'll reach that target probably as we look forward. But, okay, so, yeah, just jump in, Don. That's a good point, Rick. Let's go, Chair. Senator Myers.
On the reduction in the amount of ambient groundwater monitoring information, can you give us an idea about is that around landfills, is that in what parts of areas, where is that monitoring taking place, and with in this reduction, are you going to pass those requirements on to other political subdivisions, or is there no longer going to be a requirement for those measurements?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Relative to that, the groundwater monitoring is not associated with municipal solid waste landfills. This would be associated with collecting baseline information in areas so that we understand what the baseline is throughout the state. We have a program where we're working with the USGS to collect information to to have that database available in areas, sensitive areas.
Mr. Chairman, I think we had a good deal of discussion last year about trying to get some of that baseline stuff, especially where we were going to have fracking, just to make sure that it wasn't the industry's fault if the materials were already there. So now you're telling us we're losing that opportunity to have that data in those circumstances?
Mr. Chairman, we're still collecting information through the USGS program. Just the amount of data that we would be able to collect would be reduced by that amount. So to some extent, I think you're right that the amount of information that we would be able to collect would be reduced.
Mr. Chair, I'm just concerned about the critical mass of data that we need for defense of our industry and to protect the general public safety and welfare. And so I need to kind of have a comfort level or at least some idea about this particular reduction. So if you could get us some information, some specific information about where you're going to make these reductions so we know where the hot spots might be, because that's something that's, last year was right on the forefront.
Yeah.
And this year we're putting it on the back burner, and I just want to make sure there's still enough heat on whatever's left.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
But maybe continue comments on that. I mean, these aren't real drastic budget cuts by any means to this unit. Any other? You're going to be able to get us information. I think the senator's, obviously his point's well taken. Comment any further? I think we're going to get the job done with these cuts.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, you're right. It's not the entire budget for doing groundwater monitoring by any means, and we're also working with the industry. They have groundwater monitoring programs in a lot of instances where they're collecting information under their programs. So there's still information being collected. We're still working very closely with the USGS to collect additional information and with their support as well. So, yeah. But we will provide some information to answer Senator Meyer's question.
Yeah, and his comments are well taken, and his questions right on. Anyone else? Mr. Co-Chair?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The question I have, Todd, is that, and I don't think this directly affects it, but I know that the department is responsible for certifying all of the people out there within the municipalities and maybe with the counties that deal with the sewer and water. And there's a CLE they go through, kind of like anybody else would. And I know what's going on in some of the small communities. You have one guy that turns the lights on, turns the lights off, does sewer, does water, does solid waste, does it all. And I think I corresponded with somebody in your department to, there's got to be a better way than having him go to five different training sessions. And my question is this affecting that? Because that's a way I think you could save some money by having a consolidation of those rather than, he spends out of Dubois, and I can't remember the times, but it seems to me like, I'll say a month of a year going to being certified that's just a stretch in what you're doing. Have you looked at that, and is that a way to possibly save some money by that consolidation? And this is just this is just water quality, so I'm thinking maybe the water quality would be like for the water part of the cities, and then the sewer might be solid waste where Carl is. Would this be a way to save some money?
Mr. Chairman, I would say that's something that certainly is worth taking a look at. I can't tell you offhand exactly how that might work out. I will say that in the operator certification program, we have done some things to make it easier to get the certification and track some things relative to certification with IT implementation projects. But I would agree that if we can simplify the process where we don't have to use as much staff time to do training and can consolidate that, it would benefit not only the local communities but also benefit the agency as far as the budget goes.
Yeah, would you do that, Mr. Co-Chair? And I'll tell you, Steve's from Midwest and I'm from Shoshone, and one of the qualifications to run for mayor Shoshone used to be you had to deal with the water, sewer, and all those systems and take care of them physically.
Right.
And I mean, look into that, and you don't need to get back to us right now, but look into that if you would, please. And maybe there's a way to do that better, save a little money, and if you can find it, you know, we won't take it away from you. That's be something we'll let them keep, maybe, if they can do that, right, Steve?
Okay, Senator Perkins.
Just kind of along the same lines as that Senator Meyer had, Todd, on the when you're looking here in the reductions with respect to contractor support for the operation and maintenance of the division's various databases. So, I guess my question is simply, as you make those cuts, and particularly if you move forward and further cut those things, is that just a temporary thing, or ultimately when we cut here, does that reduce the veracity and the utility of these databases, which we've probably spent millions of dollars with to collect and maintain the data? And I just do we have concerns moving forward that we're going to lose the integrity or the utility of these databases?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, very good question. And the reductions are based on what we've seen from historical references as to what we need to support these IT systems. And in some cases, we may have overestimated what those costs might be. And with the formation of ETS, we're also hopeful that we will have more internal support, state internal support, than what we've had in the past.
Further questions? Okay, continue on then.
Okay, I would, Mr. Chairman, direct your attention to page 4 of the handout and move to land quality, which is on page 25 of the budget. Now, as I mentioned at the outset, on page 6 there's a summary table of the reductions, and the agency's original proposal was to reduce professional fees by $200,000, and it was discovered that we didn't have $200,000 worth of general fund in professional fees. We had only $60,000 of that was general fund. The rest was federal funded. So the governor's recommendation, which we support, is to take a position from land quality that was above the cap and had been vacant for over a year, mm-hmm. as part of the 8% reduction for land quality. And so there you'll see the associated funding with that position as the recommended reduction, along with $60,000 of the professional fees.
Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How long did you say that position was vacant?
It was somewhere around a year, from my understanding, because it was above the cap and frozen, so we weren't able to hire that position.
Okay, so I'm looking at your page 3 of your slide here under land quality, and it refers to a position that was originally approved in the 2012 supplemental budget to address non-coal mineral development. So is this a different position, the same position? How's that work?
If I could have Mr. Dill try to answer that question.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wallace, no, that is the same position we're referencing. In the 2012 supplemental budget actually gave us that position effective immediately. So that would have been, help me just a moment here, I guess, would have been in March of 11. And it had never been filled since it was granted to our agency. So,
Mr. Chairman, I'm contemplating non-coal mineral development and what I've heard about what's going on around the state, and I'm thinking rare earth minerals possibly. Is there something else, and do you have any activity in that area, or why was that position not filled?
Mr. Chairman, the position was originally contemplated to assist with the uranium development.
Mm.
And the position wasn't filled because it did fall above the agency cap, and it was one of the positions. I don't recall all the dynamics behind that, but it has been frozen. And perhaps Mr. Uzel can explain how long that's been a frozen position.
Well, shortly after, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wallace, shortly after it was approved for us, the A&I and the governor's office came in and, as you're aware, implemented caps within agencies. And, you know, I don't remember the exact date, but it was about 9 months ago, if I recall right. And so the position had been granted to us. We were looking at going forward with it, as Mr. Parfit said, for the uranium industry. Then it was frozen because it was a vacant position, so it remained above the agency cap. And so I'm saying there was at least 9 months under the freeze or the cap, and the rest of the time was just shortly after we got it, and we just hadn't got around to filling it yet. I hope that answered your question. Yeah.
It does, Mr. Chairman. But so in your department, how many people do you have to deal with uranium, rare earth minerals, those things that are going on?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to look to Ms. Bilbro to perhaps answer that question as how many we have that are non-coal related positions. Mr. Chairman, we're going to have to get back with you on the exact number of that.
No worries. Mr. Chairman, since we're on the topic of positions, would you remind me? I know that in one of my early years here in the legislative body, we had the grand luxury of a lot of coal bed methane development going on, and there was a big issue because the department was not able to provide permits on a timely basis. So I think we increased your staffing level substantially during that time. Would you remind me of how many positions we added during that time and what the status of those are now? Have we taken those away, or have we transferred them to some other area? What have we done there?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that I can answer the question about the exact numbers, and we can get back with you on that. But you are correct. During the development of coal bed methane, there were positions that were added to the surface water discharge program to manage that workload. Since that has slowed substantially, some of those positions have been moved to the underground injection control program to address increases that we've seen there with oil and gas development in other areas and uranium mining permitting activities under the UIC program. Some of the positions were, I suspect, transferred to other program needs and areas within the agency rather than coming back to the legislature for additional positions in those areas. So those positions have been managed to meet the needs of the agency, I believe. But the exact tracking of all those positions, I couldn't tell you offhand, but we can certainly get back to you on that. And I think Mr. Uzel.
Mr. Chairman, would you, when you get back with us on that, would you kind of give us a sheet or something that shows us what's the year we've been using, 2001 and 2, or the number of positions in 2000 or at some point in time, and then what we are now and kind of what the growth of the department has been and in what areas? And
so growth of your agency really in positions in the last decade is what we're kind of looking at. And I think Senator Meyer was here, and you remember the number. The number 40, I think, sticks in my head. But Senator Meyer's question?
Chairman, the number was pretty close to that, and there was an extensive study, and the governor remarked about it when I queried him when he was here. It's about three years old, I think, now, the study as to basically justify the movement out of the permitting into most of it went into solid waste and land quality, if I recall most of those positions. And I think you had in that 36 range or something like that that have been transferred over. The study's probably outdated as far as the justification. I think at some point in time you're going to have to re-justify those. And we see this in a lot of different areas. I know
gosh, it's back in about 97, 24 people got into Department of Family Services for the deadbeat dad scenario. They're supposed to be at-will contracts for 3 years, and they're still there, you know. So, you know, it happens. You get, I guess, a position stick, you know, however it goes, and you guys find something to, for those people to do, you know. But times are getting a little tougher, and so, you know, I know we tried to take six positions out, and the governor vetoed three last year in the last biennium that got to his desk. So, you know, I'm not going to beat you up too bad this year, but, you know, we'll probably go back after some of those. But I got a question, and this will show my ignorance, Mr. Chairman. What is a Kaizen or a Kaizen event? You know, I'm clueless. I haven't heard that term before. So that has to do with your land quality and something that you won't be able to do now. And I'm kind of interested in what you can do because I don't know what it is.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, the what's referred to as the Kaizen process is essentially a streamlining process where you bring in all the stakeholders associated with, for example, a permitting process, and you evaluate that permitting process from the start to the finish, and you identify what components that you need and what you don't need and how to make the system move through the process as expeditiously or as smoothly as possible. And do you take out unnecessary steps that build up over time? And so we've done that with many of our programs within the agency, primarily when we're getting ready to develop information technology systems. We want to have the most efficient system in place that we're going to put into an electronic system rather than an outdated system that, you know, things have changed. So that's essentially what it is.
So you'll still try to do that. I mean, you're not going to operate with your eyes closed, I'm assuming.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we will still work to have an efficient operation by all means.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eisenhower. Just to follow up on Senator Meyer's statements, there's a bunch of history there that obviously us new folks don't know about having 3 years ago having a study about adding 40, justifying 36, and I would really appreciate getting some type of a couple-page synopsis of that history, of the 3 years ago report on how they justified keeping them, and just so we can be better educated on reviewing that information.
So you get us that information?
Yeah,
kind of
Mr. Chairman.
Show us that movement. That'd be good for all of us. Appreciate it.
Yes.
Okay. Don, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, you asked me to jump in when there are biennialization issues.
Please.
Two comments. First of all, in this water quality, they are reducing that position by 24 months. So next biennium, they will either have to find another position or find other areas to cut.
Right.
And then also a handout that we provided yesterday shows the total growth in the agency over the past 12 years is 69 employees. Approximately a third of the agency has grown.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Any other?
And just for clarification, on the 24-month issue, on just eliminating for that, I understand that's more of a procedural out position, but the position's not coming back, right? Isn't
correct.
That correct?
Yeah. That's correct, is my understanding.
Yeah, that's correct, Mr. Chairman.
But it can't be biennialized as we move forward to an 8% cut.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we recognize that as well.
Yeah, and that's so I guess we're trying to send the word out and on really this whole expenditure control of budgeting, just a mindset of not can we spend it all, but how can we save some? How can we do it more efficiently? And I know you do that, but it's really a focus on the whole on all of state government, really. Okay, moving on, I think. We're ready to move on.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, moving on to the Solid and Hazardous Waste Division, which is remaining on page 3 of the handout, but going to page 33 of the budget. The reductions in the Solid and Hazardous Waste Division are $251,000, nearly $252,000 in support services and professional fees. This is the governor's recommendation, and we support that recommendation.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Perfitt. On the brownfield sites and the underground storage tanks and things like that, where are you? Is the list growing? Is the list stagnant? Is the list decreasing as far as the number of sites that are up and listed and we're monitoring and looking at?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that I can tell you right now what the list of brownfield sites are. It's something that we can provide to you, though, as far as how fast that list may be growing. I will mention that on the orphan site projects that we do have, we are working to pare that down through some of the funding that we've received in previous years, but we're probably about halfway through that list.
Okay, thank you.
Now, we've had some changes, obviously, AML funds, but we're still going to get a small portion moving forward, and you're kind of planning and looking ahead to that, and we'll have more discussions. As far as the penny, the leaking underground storage tanks, the less penny, how are those? I mean, it's kind of piggybacking on those. How many are we, I guess, what's the lineup looking up? What's the list looking like? Do you have those things out into the future, or do you just kind of deal them as they show up?
Mr. Chairman, we do have a list of all the sites with the underground storage tank program. We can provide that to you, but yeah, we maintain that list and it's prioritized, and then there's a plan that's developed looking 3 years forward. We can provide that to you. I think there's an expectation that list will someday end, but there are new sites that are identified, sites that may have been cleaned up where they have new spills or new releases. Now, the pace may be not the same as it was when the program first started.
I think that's information I'm interested in. I think Senator Perkins, because as we look at this new emerging landfill issue and try to figure out how to fund that into the next decades of work, trying to put it all together in the big picture. So that's, I think the pace of that is important information for us.
Mr. Chairman, we can provide that.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else? Any other questions? Okay.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, and I'll take you to, if I may take you to page 5 of the handout and page 38 of the supplemental budget. And Mr. Chairman, this exception budget request is for $15 million into the municipal solid waste landfill account. Point out that the origin of this request is the current budget specifies that the governor shall include additional funding of not less than $15 million per year for the account, and this is the budget request for 2014.
Questions? Representative Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Parfit, as we're looking forward and kind of to piggyback on the chairman's question, and I know, Chairman Bebout and Representative Moniz have been involved in these discussions, but as we try to get a grip on what we're going to need going forward, we've kind of got some ranges on the big dollar amount. But, my question is, when do you anticipate we will start expending funds from these accounts? We've got the two bills moving through this session, and there will probably be some rulemaking. So my thought is we may not even expend any this biennium. But is that an accurate assumption? And then secondly, are you starting to get any grip on what the burn rate will be on this fund? I mean, obviously we're not going to deal with the full extent of the problem right away. It's going to be a thing we tackle over time. And so as we move forward, it seemed like in minerals maybe we kind of picked a number out of the air to get things going, but have you made any more progress on figuring out what those demands look like in the next few years?
Mr. Chairman, I think your assumption on the first part of your question about the when we would be able to expend funds, it is correct. Just a little bit of background. Right now, the municipal solid waste landfill account has $30 million in it. This would bring that account up to $45 million. If the two House bills that have been introduced provided that those are passed by the legislature, we would then go into rulemaking. And that will take sometime 9 to 12 months, I would suspect, to have the rulemaking in place before we could start expending funds. So I think your assumption is correct there. As far as the burn rate, one of the things when we met with this committee last year was a request that we work with the Minerals Committee to develop a plan and a prioritization of how we would address the sites on the list. And we've done that. We've worked through the Minerals Committee. That's the genesis of the two House bills, 65 and 66. But we also submitted a prioritization report to LSO in December and prioritizes the top 11 sites and gives cost estimates for those top 11 sites, which is somewhere in the neighborhood of $31 million. And that's where we would most likely start. However, I would say that there are other sites on the list that may not be in the top 11 that, if it makes sense and where we can gain some efficiencies and cost savings, we would try to do that.
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman. With those top 11, though, and the $31 million, is it anticipated that that would be an appropriation for 1 year or one biennium, or is that going to be a process that takes place over time and an expenditure that takes place over time?
Mr. Chairman, my expectation was that would be an expense or an expenditure that would take place over time.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And follow up on Representative Stubson, those two bills, I believe one of them's got a, and you're right, we just had a real scientific analysis. We pulled up in the air, and I think you came up with $40 million. Maybe it was me. But that's out there for the committee's information. That one bill has a $40 million appropriation. And the theory being, as you all recall, when we started down this path on solid waste, the initial study you completed in, what, Todd, it would have been 3 years ago now, I believe, showed an exposure of potentially $240 million for these sites that were already contaminated to clean them up, the orphan sites and some of those things. That's a real moving number, and I don't think that's been updated lately, but hopefully you'll get a better handle on that. And then the other bill has got about $8 or $9 million appropriation to deal with that. And Mr. Co-Chair, you and I both shared the same idea about lust. And by the way, the DEQ, yeah, that's gone out to the state of Wyoming. Let me rephrase that.
Yeah. Actually, worldwide.
The co-chair and I, we have an idea on how to better appropriate money from the state of Wyoming to do a good cause for a good project. How's that sound?
Right on target.
I've not said anything more about it. But anyway, and you gave a pretty comprehensive report about why we may not want to do that right now. But that is on our minds, Todd, to shift into that gradually, and I think that might be a good way to do that. So just a heads up for the committee.
Yeah, and I think part of that would, as you kind of bring back information, how the current cap works, how we could maybe alter that, how, you know, to provide a stable funding source that we really don't see, that's not a general fund $15 million hit every year, because that'll get tougher and tougher, I think, as we move forward into our revenue picture.
Mr. Chairman, I might add, you know, as Senator Bebout pointed out, that the original, and I would characterize it as a very conservative estimate, was $240 million for all of the landfills that were identified in that groundwater report back in 2010. We're starting to get to a point where we can refine those numbers, and we'll have a better picture as we move forward.
Further questions? Okay. Anything else? Further.
Mr. Chairman, that's all I have for our presentation, and
Mr. Co-Chair. Questions.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And I know Alan's back there. I think it's important for this committee, and we're all very familiar with what happened with the AML funds, and now we're reduced to $15 million. But Alan, who's in charge of the AML division, has been moving forward, and I'll let him explain it better, but he's been a very conservative approach to how he's been spending that money, so there will not be a stop in the coal reclamation, if you will. It's going to be a phased out over a period of a couple, 3 years, and then hopefully our congressional delegation might be able to somewhat change that sinking ship around so we can get back what's rightfully ours. Would the committee be interested in hearing from Alan about that?
Absolutely. I mean, we've got
the time.
We've got time. You know, what we'd like to do, if
5, 10 minutes maybe, or would that work for you?
Yes,
please. And then we've got a short one before we go in. That'll be, I think we're right on schedule then.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Obviously, with the reduction of the funds, we've had to face a sort of a challenging situation to redirect and reconfigure our program. And we've been doing quite a bit of work along those lines. The approach that we took, and Director Cora was involved with this, and we've been working closely with Todd as well, is adjusting our program to reflect the current reality, but keeping the program flexible enough to ramp back up quickly should the funds be restored. So we know there's a lot of effort still ongoing with that, so if all or part of the funds are restored, we want to be in a position to effectively apply those without a lot of delay. So relative to the reality of the funds that we have, and I'll touch on that first, we're capped at the $15 million. The jury is still out, or Congress, so to speak, on whether or not those funds will be sequestered when they deal with the budget. But for now, we're looking at the $15 million. We have the funding, for an example, from FY13 that was approved by the legislature this last year. That was $66.8 million. We have a little bit of funding from the previous year as well that we haven't gotten totally through the system yet. So the approach that we've taken is keeps in mind that we have a lot of contractors and a lot of people who rely heavily upon that source of funds for some of the work and some of the projects they have. So what we've done is we've had to readjust some of our priorities, and we've shifted some of our projects a little bit further forward. So instead of all of a sudden just hitting a cliff, if you'll pardon the expression, but a rapid drop off of the funding, so we have $66 million worth of work and then we have 15, that would present a lot of serious problems. So what we've done is we've phased that out, so we will reach down to that level over the course of the next 2 to 3 years. So we'll keep projects in the pipeline, keep the opportunities there for the jobs and the economic benefit that goes with that. To address the what if additional funds are restored in either all or part, we're currently in the process of going through our last round of professional solicitations. We have a lot of projects left on our inventory. As a matter of fact, between our coal and our non-coal, we have remaining approximately $429 million worth of unfunded reclamation. Not all of that reclamation we would probably do. Some of those are small projects. Some we would do more harm than good if you try to do work. So we're prioritizing and working down. But by going through the professional solicitation, we will have consultants on board to do some of the preliminary work on the highest priority remaining projects that we have. Then, if funding is restored, we basically have some projects on the shelf that are real close and ready to go. So as the funding comes in, we're ready to ramp up quickly. And to do that, of course, is a benefit, to the companies and the contractors that we work with. But it also would apply the funds as quickly as possible, so further mischief wouldn't occur, if you understand my term. So we're positioned to deal with the reality of the funding, plus leaving the option open on how to ramp back up quickly should funding be restored. So we're trying to balance the two issues.
Yeah, I got one. Ellen, while we're on that, and at least what I've heard from our congressional delegation, and I think we're spending, and we have spent, the ML1s. AML funds properly and within the law, and what we, even though we've been certified, I think everything we've done was legitimate and legal, and I don't think that there's anybody that would argue that. My question is, as we move forward, just a perception out there, and it's about 95% of the world is about perception rather than reality. Do we need to focus what you're doing any more to like the coal related? Do you think there's benefits to do that? Are you thinking about that, or are you comfortable with your program you laid out?
Mr. Chairman, Let me address the first point you made and just touch on that. It is unfortunate that the perception that was made in the press gave the impression that Wyoming had squandered the money. I mean, that clearly was the indication that came out of the one article. In the truth, the state has spent the money well within the law, within the intent of the law, and a lot of the money has been spent for exactly what it was intended to. Our traditional reclamation program has done nothing but reclamation. So there is an incredible investment in that, and it's an investment the state was continuing to make. Senator Bebout, I know we've made the presentation to your committee, but for those here, I think it's also important to note, even under the prior balance funds, it was the legislature who took the discretionary prior balance money in the first 2 years and funded coal reclamation so the state could honor and meet the $30 million a year coal requirement that has been established by the Office of Surface Mining. Relative to the current funding that we have, the initial indication from OSM was that all the reclamation funding going forward would have to be spent first for coal. And that's just a carryover from where we were. The agreement reached with OSM in 2008 after the amendments was that a minimum of $30 million a year would be spent on coal until it's complete. If my memory serves me correct, we have about $180 million left in that category. Again, some of those we wouldn't do for the reasons I mentioned earlier, but we need to get out in the field and evaluate that. The issue, though, is we do have some high-priority hazards that are non-coal. So the discussions we're having now with OSM is, will they, in fact, require everything to be on coal, because we're able to do that, or will they allow some balance of coal plus the high-priority non-coal? We still have non-coal hazards of open shafts, open adits, high walls close to communities and popular recreation areas. So that's a little bit of a discussion going forward, but the primary emphasis will still remain on coal.
I think we had Senator Meyer.
Just to get back a little bit on the staffing levels that you have, I think your agency and probably State Engineer's office are probably two agencies that need to have a little excess capacity in your staffing from the standpoint if we have an opportunity to move forward with some energy development or other development, that we need to be able to move on that quickly. That being said, have you ever considered looking at a staffing arrangement and I'm asking whether this might work, where you'd have a certain percentage of your staff, 3, 4, 5, 6 people that were trained in multi-disciplines, so you could be like a utility man on a auto assembly plant, you could move them into different areas, maybe reduce the total number of your staff, but maybe train part of your staff in multi-discipline so you'd have that flexibility to move, you know, in the areas where you really might need them. And I'm just curious as to whether you ever given that any thought as far as a personnel management option.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, specifically as you describe it, not in that sense. However, we do promote the basically the cross training within the divisions, and in fact, what we do see is that a lot of people within the agency have worked for several of the divisions, and so we have that level of expertise throughout the agency. But as far as having kind of a special squad or special team in place to address those issues kind of on the fly, we haven't really thought of it that way, but something worth thinking about.
Okay, I think we're about ready to wrap up here.
I got a quick one. And just for a full disclosure for the committee, I'm involved and associated with a company that bids on AML projects. I want you all to know that. That's a competitive bid, and I've been doing that for many years. The question I have is you know, that you came up from the assistant or the deputy director. Are you going to fill that position? Is that something that's out there you're talking about, Todd? I know it's a little premature, maybe. Have you given that any thought?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I have given that some thought and have put out a posting, and I'm in the process of evaluating a variety of applicants.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Everybody's good. Okay, well, thank you for your presentation. We appreciate it.
and I appreciate your good work.
All right.
Thank you. Insurance Department, Agency 44.
Boy, you right on schedule.
And we're about a minute behind. We've got about 15 minutes. And I guess I'd say the committee, you can look at these cuts, and you'll take us through it, Commissioner. Don't want to delve off into the ACA issues too much with your department. So, I just think there'll be another day with the health department on that, on a callback. And so go ahead, Commissioner. Welcome. Introduce and go ahead and get started.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Tom Hersig, the new insurance commissioner. I've been here about 8 months now, so this is my first time through this process. So with me I have Peter Griff, who is a policy analyst with the Department of Insurance. He also oversees our WIP pool, which is our high-risk health insurance plan. Specifically, that's where our budget cut come from. For those of you that don't know, the Department of Insurance is funded by all the insurance companies that transact business within the state of Wyoming. So we're the only general fund appropriation we have is for the WIP program. So with that being said, if you'd like me to expand upon that budget cut, is that?
Absolutely. And I think, and then the discussion we'll have to have in this committee is how that's going to affect people you serve. You brought a spreadsheet with numbers, and maybe give us all that background information, how these cuts will affect people out there.
Okay. I'm going to turn it over to Peter to go over the numbers with you, and then I can come back and discuss what the philosophy of those cuts might entail. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Mr. Chairman, if you take a look at the spreadsheet, I've listed the last 4 years of total appropriations used for the WIP program. We're allocated $3 million per year, and we've never gone over that $3 million. So the 8% budget cut would reduce that by $240,000. So I don't see it being a problem. However, that is somewhat speculative, as we don't know what the claims will be from year to year for the high-risk pool. The other funding that is used is assessments on insurance companies doing business here in the state of Wyoming. We can assess up to $6 million per year. As you can see on that chart, we've never really gone over $2 million in the last 4 years. So we do have some leeway. So if the budget cut goes through and we're not able to use as much general fund money, we still have the ability to assess insurance companies if we have higher claims.
And this ability to assess will continue with the federal changes to the ACA. You'll still have that ability or moving forward. And I guess that's the quick question. Does our decisions on whether to do an optional expansion of Medicaid or a federal exchange, how is that going to affect these folks, these 400 or 726 folks enrolled, or how many? 1,000 folks enrolled, I guess, in 2012.
Mr. Chairman, with the changes to the ACA, it really doesn't affect the amount that we're able to assess. It's in statute that we can assess any company that's writing health insurance business in the state. The pool is set to sunset on June 30th, 2015, so changes to the ACA wouldn't affect our ability to assess insurance companies.
Okay, and then the second part of that question was the optional expansion. Will that cover these folks and this program can go away, or how does that...
Mr. Chairman, with the implementation of the ACA, one of the things that comes with it is they can't underwrite for any health conditions. So we would expect that part of this population, or probably about half of it, would be seeking insurance in the private marketplace that they haven't been able to seek before because of their health conditions. So the population in here that we have is the under 65 disabled that use this for a Medicare supplement plan, that there really is not a product for them out there, but they're not the costly part of this program. So our best guess is that a lot of people will be able to seek private insurance that haven't been able to in the past. So as far as the effect on the Medicaid expansion, I don't think those two are related at all.
Representative Escobel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Director.
There's a couple other bills out there that would allow residents of the state of Wyoming to purchase insurance from out-of-state insurance companies. How would those companies and assessments be affected by your department?
Mr. Chairman, there is those two bills, the purchase and the sale of insurance across state lines. We're probably not going to see, in the landscape that's out there right now in the health insurance industry, we're probably not going to see an immediate impact of lots of movement between the state lines, because the insurance companies, quite frankly, have their plates full right now, and expanding across state lines is probably not on their radar. Those laws have been passed in 9 states, and not one policy has been sold doing that. But we don't know what that landscape's going to look like within the next year. But as far as revenues to the state, if a company is doing business and they're selling products to these citizens, we probably will not receive those premium taxes if they're operating out of another state.
Any other information then you'd like to? I guess my sense of this then, there's not, out of these 1,000 folks, we're probably not going to throw one person off that roll in the coming year with these cuts. That's my sense of it right now.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a correct assessment.
And I think that was an issue coming in, so appreciate your information. Anyone else?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Moniz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you don't mind, Tom, could you give us, in your opinion, the pros and cons of selling insurance across state lines?
Mr. Chairman, the pros and cons, if it was relative for an insurance company to do business across state lines, I liken it to the fact that if somebody in California, who's historically auto rates are very high, looks at Wyoming and they say, you know, I want Wyoming's auto rates, companies still have to provide their mark, their premiums based on what their costs are in that area. And typically in the state of Wyoming, health insurance costs are higher than most other places. So for a company to expand in Wyoming, one of the cons that I see is as far as network adequacy, they might be driven to have to go somewhere out of state for their health care. If a person purchased a policy in Nebraska, for example, they live on that border, they may have to go to Nebraska for all their health care. So that would be one of the cons. We've never had an insurance company come to us and say, you know, we'd expand our market if you would pass this. So with that being said, if I knew what that landscape looked like a year from now, it's going to change immensely, and I'm not so sure that just having that tool in our tool chest may become relative. I really can't answer that, but if it's not there and we could have used it, that would be one of the pros of having it.
Just a quick question I have on the funding of your 24 positions. Is that out of those assessments, that up to $6 million level, or is that a different kind of fee that you assess?
Mr. Chairman, that's a different fee. Okay. That's a separate fee where we assess all the companies. Evenly pay for the department costs.
Very good. Any other questions before we wrap it up? We're going to go in here and, oh, yes, Representative Esquil.
Just a quick request that when we have the Department of Health call back, that the Department of Insurance is here with them as well. So there's going to be questions, I'm sure. That
you think that's
cross back and forth between the two agencies?
That'd be okay? That'd be fine?
Mr. Chairman, absolutely.
It'll just be another short one, I'm sure, with the Department of Health.
I just got a question,
and
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nicholas.
And once again, there's some new folks in here. It seems to me that we don't have any mechanism to prevent or control outside insurance folks to come in. And any fly-by-nighters that just show up and say, we're going to give you a lower premium. I mean, what's the mechanism for preventing that or monitoring that? That spooks me a little bit.
Mr. Chairman, right now an insurance company cannot do business within the state unless they're And if we're specifically talking about health insurance, unless they're licensed and their plan is approved in the state. If it, going back to the purchase or sale of insurance across state lines, that's another very good fear is that companies could come out there and market health plans that maybe don't even fit so that you won't get fined. If we don't approve the plans coming within the state, we really don't know what our citizens are going to be purchasing if we open those lines up.
And so what's the process for doing it? How are we preparing ourselves to address that issue?
Mr. Chairman, right now they can't do it. If we would pass the purchase or sale of insurance across state lines, the way those two bills read right now, the company at least has to be licensed here, but they don't. The plan management, as far as us approving what they're selling, that piece is not in there. So the feeling is that companies will come to do business if they don't have to go through that process. But the process of an insurance company wanting to do business in the state of Wyoming takes about 40 days for them to get a plan approved, get licensed, and up and running in the state. It's a very minimal cost for them to do that. So right now, the way those bills pass, we would not have any regulation over what those companies would offer.
And have you made any suggested amendments to those in order to put some type of a fee or a monitoring fee or an overview fee on those
bills? Can I, before you answer that, the senators are going in at 10 o'clock, so you guys need to leave. And I think House members, we've got a little extra time. We've got a computer training. And so we're going to say we're going to recess at 3 o'clock. If you don't mind just answering a few questions from the committee. Representative Wallace, you have to leave right now. Is that right?
Pretty quick, yeah.
So I think we're going to shut this down right now. But I think we'll call them informal questions. If you have a few minutes to kind of – and we understand the biennialization issues with this fund. Okay. Thanks for coming in. We're going to...
I was going to ask a question about interstate compacts and how Wyoming approved the structure of the policy, like in life policies and things. But I don't know with the ACA whether or not we're going to have that ability to approve the form of the issuing the state.